Alas that I bore thee at a time when Nimrod is king. For thy sake 70,000 men children were slaughtered, and I am seized with terror on account of thee, that he hear of thy existence and slay thee. Better thou shouldst perish here in this cave than my eye should behold thee dead at my breast. She took the garment in which she was clothed, and wrapped it about the boy. Then she abandoned him in the cave, saying, May the Lord be with thee, may he not fail thee nor forsake thee. Thus Abraham was deserted in the cave, without a nurse, and he began to wail. God sent Gabriel down to give him milk to drink, and the angel made it to flow from the little finger of the baby's right hand, and he sucked it until he was 10 days old. Then he arose and walked about, and he left the cave and went along the edge of the valley. When the sun sank and the stars came forth, he said, These are the gods. But the dawn came and the stars could be seen no longer. And then he said, I will not pay worship to these, for they are no gods. Thereupon the sun came forth and he spoke, This is my God. Him will I extol. But again the sun set, and he said, He is no god. And beholding the moon, he called him his god, to whom he would pay divine homage. Then the moon was obscured, and he cried out, This too is no god. There is one who sets them all in motion.
The Blackfeet of Montana tell of a young monster slayer, Kutoyis, who was discovered by his foster parents when the old man and woman put a clot of buffalo blood to boil in a pot.
Immediately there came from the pot a noise as of a child crying, as if it were being hurt, burnt, or scalded. They looked in the kettle and saw there a little boy, and they quickly took it out of the water. They were very much surprised. Now on the fourth day the child spoke and said, Lash me in turn to each of these lodge poles, and when I get to the last one, I shall fall out of my lashing and be grown up. The old woman did so, and as she lashed him to each lodge pole, he could be seen to grow, and finally, when they lashed him to the last pole, he was a man.
The folk tales commonly support or supplant this theme of the exile with that of the despised one, or the handicapped, the abused youngest son or daughter, the orphan, stepchild, ugly duckling, or the squire of low degree. A young Pueblo woman, who was helping her mother mix clay for pottery with her foot, felt a splash of mud on her leg, but thought no more of it.
After some days, the girl felt something was moving in her belly, but she did not think anything about going to have a baby. She did not tell her mother, but it was growing and growing. One day in the morning she was very sick. In the afternoon she got the baby. Then her mother knew, for the first time, that her daughter was going to have a baby. The mother was very angry about it. But after she looked at the baby, she saw it was not like a baby. She saw it was a round thing with two things sticking out. It was a little jar. Where did you get this? Said her mother. The girl was just crying. About that time the father came in. Never mind. I am very glad she had a baby, he said. But it is not a baby, said her mother. Then the father went to look at it and saw it was a little water jar. After that, he was very fond of that little jar. It is moving, he said. Pretty soon, that little water jar was growing. In 20 days, it was big. It was able to go around with the children, and it could talk. Grandfather, take me outdoors so I can look around, he said. So every morning, the grandfather would take him out, and he would look at the children, and they were very fond of him. And they found out he was a boy, water jar boy. They found out from his talking.
In sum, the child of destiny has to face a long period of obscurity. This is a time of extreme danger, impediment, or disgrace. he is thrown inward to his own depths or outward to the unknown. Either way, what he touches is a darkness unexplored. And this is a zone of unsuspected presences, benign as well as malignant. An angel appears, a helpful animal, a fisherman, a hunter, crone, or peasant. Fostered in the animal school, or like Siegfried, below ground among the gnomes that nourish the roots of the tree of life. Or again, alone in some little room. The story has been told a thousand ways. The young world apprentice learns the lesson of the seed powers, which reside just beyond the sphere of the measured and the named. The myths agree that an extraordinary capacity is required to face and survive such experiences. The infancies abound in anecdotes of precious strength, cleverness, and wisdom. Heracles strangled a serpent sent against his cradle by the goddess Hera. Maui of Polynesia snared and slowed the sun to give his mother time to cook her meals. Abraham, as we have seen, arrived at the knowledge of the one God. Jesus confounded the wise men. The baby Buddha had been left one day beneath the shade of a tree. His nurses suddenly noted that the shadow had not moved all afternoon and that the child was sitting fixed in a yogic trance. The feats of the beloved Hindu savior, Krishna, during his infant exile among the cowherds of Gokula and Vrindavan, constitute a lively cycle. A certain goblin named Putana came in the shape of a beautiful woman, but with poison in her breasts. She entered the house of Yasoda, the foster mother of the child, and made herself very friendly, presently taking the baby in her lap to give it suck. But Krishna drew so hard that he sucked away her life, and she fell dead, reassuming her huge and hideous form. When the foul corpse was cremated, however, it emitted a sweet fragrance, for the divine infant had given the demoness salvation when he had drunk her milk. Krishna was a mischievous little boy. He liked to spirit away the pots of curds when the milkmaids were asleep. He was forever climbing to eat and spill things placed out of his reach on the high shelves. The girls would call him Butter Thief and complain to Yasoda, but he could always invent a story. One afternoon when he was playing in the yard, his foster parent was warned that he was eating clay. She arrived with a switch, but he had wiped his lips and denied all knowledge of the matter. She opened the dirty mouth to see, but when she peered inside, beheld the whole universe, the three worlds. She thought, "How silly I am to imagine that my son could be the lord of the three worlds." Then all was veiled from her again, and the moment passed immediately from her mind. She fondled the little boy and took him home. The herding folk were accustomed to pay worship to the god Indra, the Hindu counterpart of Zeus, king of heaven and lord of rain. One day, when they had made their offering, the lad Krishna said to them, "Indra is no supreme deity. Though he be king in heaven, he is afraid of the Titans. Furthermore, the rain and prosperity for which you are praying depend on the sun, which draws up the waters and makes them fall again. What can Indra do? Whatever comes to pass is determined by the laws of nature and the spirit." Then he turned their attention to the nearby woods, streams, and hills, and especially to Mount Govardhan, as more worthy of their honor than the remote master of the air. And so they offered flowers and fruits and sweetmeats to the mountain. Krishna himself assumed a second form. He took the form of a mountain god and received the offerings of the people, meanwhile remaining in his earlier shape among them, paying worship to the mountain king. The god received the offerings and ate them up. Indra was enraged and sent for the king of the clouds, whom he commanded to pour rain over the people until all should be swept away. A flight of storm clouds drew over the district and began to discharge a deluge. It seemed the end of the world was at hand. but the lad Krishna filled Mount Govardhan with the heat of his inexhaustible energy, lifted it with his little finger, and bid the people take shelter beneath. The rain struck the mountain, hissed, and evaporated. The torrent fell 7 days, but not a drop touched the community of herdsmen. Then the god realized that the opponent must be an incarnation of the primal being. When Krishna went out next day to graze the cows, playing music on his flute, the king of heaven came down on his great white elephant, Aravata, fell on his face at the feet of the smiling lad, and made submission.
The sense of Krishna's advice to do worship to the mountain rather than the king of the gods, which to the Western reader may seem strange, is that the way of devotion, Bhakti Marga, must begin with things known and loved by the devotee, not remote, unimaginable conceptions. Since the Godhead is immanent in all, he will make himself known through any object profoundly regarded. Furthermore, it is the Godhead within the devotee that makes it possible for him to discover Godhead in the world without. This mystery is illustrated in Krishna's double presence during the act of worship.
The conclusion of the childhood cycle is the return or recognition of the hero, when, after the long period of obscurity, his true character is revealed. This event may precipitate a considerable crisis, for it amounts to an emergence of powers hitherto excluded from human life. Earlier patterns break to fragments or dissolve. Disaster greets the eye. Yet after a moment of apparent havoc, the creative value of the new factor comes to view, and the world takes shape again in unsuspected glory. This theme of crucifixion-resurrection can be illustrated either on the body of the hero himself or in his effects upon his world. The first alternative we find in the Pueblo story of the water jar.
The men were going out to hunt rabbits, and Water Jar Boy wanted to go. "Grandfather, could you take me down to the foot of the mesa? I want to hunt rabbits." "Poor grandson, you can't hunt rabbits. You have no legs or arms," said the grandfather. But Water Jar Boy was very anxious to go. "Take me anyway. You are too old and you can't do anything." His mother was crying because her boy had no legs or arms or eyes. But they used to feed him in his mouth, in the mouth of the jar. So next morning, his grandfather took him down to the south on the flat. Then he rolled along, and pretty soon he saw a rabbit track, and he followed the track. Pretty soon the rabbit ran out, and he began to chase it. Just before he got to the marsh, there was a rock, and he hit himself against it and broke. And a boy jumped up. He was very glad his skin had been broken and that he was a boy, a big boy. He was wearing lots of beads around his neck and turquoise earrings and a dance kilt and moccasins and a buckskin shirt.
Catching a number of rabbits, he returned and presented them to his grandfather, who brought him triumphantly home. The cosmic energies burning within the vivid Irish warrior Cuchulainn, chief hero of the medieval Ulster cycle, the so-called cycle of the Knights of the Red Branch, would suddenly burst like an eruption, both overwhelming himself and smashing everything around.
The legendary cycles of medieval Ireland include 1. The mythological cycle, which describes the migrations to the island of prehistoric peoples, their battles, and in particular, the deeds of the race of gods known as the Tuatha De Danann, children of the great mother Dana. 2. The annals of the Milesians, or semi-historical chronicles of the last arriving race, the sons of Milesius, founders of the Celtic dynasties that survived until the arrival of the Anglo-Normans under Henry II in the 12th century. 3. The Ulster cycle of the Knights of the Red Branch, which treats primarily of the deeds of Cuchulainn, at the court of his uncle, Conaher. This cycle greatly influenced the development of the Arthurian tradition in Wales, Brittany, and England, the court of Conahor serving as model for that of King Arthur, and the deeds of Cahoolan for those of Arthur's nephew, Sir Gawain. Gawain was the original hero of many of the adventures later assigned to Lancelot, Percival, and Galahad. 4. The cycle of the Fianna. The Fianna were a company of heroic fighters under the captaincy of Finn MacCool, the greatest tale of this cycle being that of the love triangle of Finn, Grianni, his bride, and Dermot, his nephew, many episodes of which come down to us in the celebrated tale of Tristan and Isolde. 5. Legends of the Irish Saints. The little people of the popular fairy lore of Christian Ireland are reductions of the earlier pagan divinities, the Tuatha De Danann.
When Cahoolan was 4 years old, so the story goes, he set out to test the boy corps of his uncle, King Conahor, at their own sports. Carrying his hurley of brass, ball of silver, throwing javelin and toy spear, he proceeded to the court city of Emania, where, without so much as a word of permission, he dived right in among the boys, 50 in number, who were hurling on the green and practicing martial exercises with Conahor's son, Pholomane, at their head. The whole field let fly at him. With his fists, forearms, palms, and little shield, he parried the hurleys, balls, and spears that came simultaneously from all directions. Then, for the first time in his life, he was seized with his battle frenzy, a bizarre, characteristic transformation later to be known as his paroxysm or distortion, and before anyone could grasp what was coming to pass, he had laid low 50 of the best. 5 more of the boy corps went scuttling past the king, where he sat playing chess with Fergus the Eloquent. Conahor arose and took a hand in the confusion, but Cahoolan would not lighten his hand until all the youngsters had been placed under his protection and guarantee. Cahoolan's first day under arms was the occasion of his full self-manifestation. There was nothing serenely controlled about this performance, nothing of the playful irony that we feel in the deeds of the Hindu Krishna. Rather, the abundance of Cahoolan's power was becoming known for the first time to himself as well as to everybody else. It broke out of the depths of his being, and then had to be dealt with, impromptu and fast. The happening was again at the court of King Conahor, the day Cathbad the Druid declared in prophecy of any stripling who that day should assume arms and armature that the name of such an one would transcend those of all Ireland's youths besides. His life, however, would be fleeting short. Cahoolan forthwith demanded fighting equipment. 17 sets of weapons given him he shattered with his strength, until Conahor invested him with his own outfit. Then he reduced the chariots to fragments. Only that of the king was strong enough to support his trial. Cahoolan commanded Conahor's charioteer to drive him past the distant lookout ford, and they came presently to a remote fortress, the Dun of the Sons of Nectan, where he cut off the heads of the defenders. He fastened the heads to the sides of the car. On the road back he jumped to the ground and, by sheer running and mere speed, captured 2 stags of the grandest bulk. With 2 stones he knocked out of the air 24 flying swans, and with thongs and other gear he tethered all, both the beasts and the birds, to the chariot. Lavarcan, the prophetess, beheld the pageant with alarm as it approached the city and castle of Emania. "The chariot is graced with bleeding heads of his enemies," she declared. "Beautiful white birds he has, which in the chariot bear him company, and wild, unbroken stags bound and tethered to the same." "I know that chariot fighter," the king said. "Even the little boy, my sister's son, who this very day went to the marches. Surely he will have reddened his hand, and should his fury not be timely met, all Emania's young men will perish by him." Very quickly, a method had to be contrived to abate his heat, and one was found. 150 women of the castle, and Skandlok, their leader at the head of them, reduced themselves critically to nature's garb, and without subterfuge of any kind, trooped out to meet him. The little warrior, embarrassed or perhaps overwhelmed by such a display of womanhood, averted his eyes, at which moment he was seized by the men and soused into a vat of cold water. The staves and hoops of the vessel flew asunder. A second vat boiled. The third became only very hot. Thus Cahulain was subdued and the city saved.
A beautiful boy indeed was that. 7 toes to each foot Cahulain had, and to either hand as many fingers. His eyes were bright with 7 pupils apiece, each one of which glittered with 7 gem-like sparkles. On either cheek he had 4 moles, a blue, a crimson, a green, and a yellow. Between one ear and the other he had 50 clear yellow long tresses that were as the yellow wax of bees, or like unto a brooch of the white gold, as it glints to the sun unobscured. He wore a green mantle, silver clasped upon his breast, and a gold thread shirt.
But when he was taken by his paroxysm or distortion, he became a fearsome and multiform and wondrous and hitherto unknown being. All over him, from his crown to the ground, his flesh and every limb and joint and point and articulation of him quivered. His feet, shins, and knees shifted themselves and were behind him. The frontal sinews of his head were dragged to the back of his neck, where they showed in lumps bigger than the head of a man-child aged 1 month.
One eye became engulfed in his head so far that 'tis a question whether a wild heron could have got at it where it lay against his occiput, to drag it out upon the surface of his cheek. The other eye, on the contrary, protruded suddenly, and of itself so rested upon the cheek. His mouth was twisted awry till it met his ears. Flakes of fire streamed from it. The sounding blows of the heart that pounded within him were as the howl of a band-dog doing his office, or of a lion in the act of charging bears. Among the aerial clouds over his head were visible the virulent pouring showers and sparks of ruddy fire which the seething of his savage wrath caused to mount up above him. His hair became tangled about his head, over the which, though a prime apple tree had been shaken, yet may we surmise that never an apple of them would have reached the ground, but rather that all would have been held impaled each on an individual hair, as it bristled on him for fury. His hero's paroxysm projected itself out of his forehead, and showed longer as well as thicker than the whetstone of a first-rate man-at-arms, and finally, taller, thicker, more rigid, longer than the mast of a great ship, was the perpendicular jet of dusky blood which out of his scalp's very central point shot upwards, and then was scattered to the 4 cardinal points, whereby was formed a magic mist of gloom resembling the smoky pall that drapes a regal dwelling, what time a king at nightfall of a winter's day draws near to it.
3. The Hero as Warrior. The place of the hero's birth, or the remote land of exile from which he returns to perform his adult deeds among men, is the midpoint or navel of the world. Just as ripples go out from an underwater spring, so the forms of the universe expand in circles from the source. Above the broad, unmoving depths, beneath the 9 spheres and the 7 floors of heaven, at the central point, the world navel, the quietest place on earth, where eternal summer rules and the cuckoo everlasting calls, there the white youth came to consciousness. So begins a hero myth of the Yakuts of Siberia. The white youth went forth to learn where he was and what his dwelling place was like. Eastward of him lay stretching a broad, fallow field, in the middle of which arose a mighty hill, and on the summit of the hill, a gigantic tree. The resin of that tree was transparent and sweet-scented, The bark never dried or cracked, the sap shone silver. The luxuriant leaves never wilted, and the catkins resembled a cluster of reversed cups. The summit of the tree rose over the seven heaven floors and served as a tethering post for the high god Yurin-i-Tojon, while the roots penetrated into the subterranean abysses, where they formed the pillars of the dwellings of the mythical creatures proper to that zone. The tree held conversation, through its foliage, with the beings of the sky. When the white youth turned to face south, he perceived in the midst of a green grassy plain the quiet lake of milk that no breath of wind ever stirs, and around the shores of the lake were swamps of curdle. To the north of him, a somber forest stood with trees that rustled day and night, and therein was moving every kind of beast. Tall mountains were lifting beyond it, and appeared to be wearing caps of white rabbit fur. They leaned against the sky and protected this middle place from the northern wind. A thicket of scrub stretched out to the west, and beyond it stood a forest of tall firs. Behind the forest gleamed a number of blunt-headed solitary peaks. This was the manner, then, of the world in which the white youth beheld the light of day. Presently tired, however, of being alone, he went over to the gigantic tree of life. "Honored High Mistress, mother of my tree and my dwelling place," he prayed, "everything that lives exists in pairs and propagates descendants. But I am alone. I want now to travel and to seek a wife of my own kind. I wish to measure my strength against my kind. I want to become acquainted with men, to live according to the manner of men. Do not deny me thy blessing, I do humbly pray. I bow my head and bend my knee." Then the leaves of the tree began murmuring, and a fine milk-white rain descended from them upon the white youth. A warm breath of wind could be felt. The tree began to groan, and out of its roots a female figure emerged to the waist, a woman of middle age with earnest regard, hair flowing free and bosom bare. The goddess offered her milk to the youth from a sumptuous breast, and after partaking of it he felt his strength increase 100-fold. At the same time the goddess promised the youth every happiness and blessed him in such a way that neither water nor fire, iron nor anything else should ever do him harm. From the umbilical spot the hero departs to realize his destiny. His adult deeds pour creative power into the world.
Sang the aged Wainamoinen. Lakes swelled up, and earth was shaken. And the coppery mountains trembled, and the mighty rocks resounded, and the mountains clove asunder. On the shore the stones were shattered.
The stanza of the hero bard resounds with the magic of the word of power. Similarly, the sword edge of the hero warrior flashes with the energy of the creative source. Before it fall the shells of the outworn. For the mythological hero is the champion not of things become, but of things becoming. The dragon to be slain by him is precisely the monster of the status quo. Hold fast, the keeper of the past. From obscurity the hero emerges, but the enemy is great and conspicuous in the seat of power. He is enemy, dragon, tyrant, because he turns to his own advantage the authority of his position. He is holdfast, not because he keeps the past, but because he keeps.
I am here keeping the distinction between the earlier semi-animal Titan hero, city founder, culture giver, and the later fully human type. The deeds of the latter frequently include the slaying of the former. The pythons and minotaurs, who were boon-givers of the past. A god outgrown becomes immediately a life-destroying demon. The form has to be broken, and the energies released. Not infrequently, deeds that belong to the earlier stages of the cycle are assigned to the human hero, or one of the earlier heroes may be humanized and carried on into a later day. but such contaminations and variations do not alter the general formula.
The tyrant is proud, and therein resides his doom. He is proud because he thinks of his strength as his own. Thus he is in the clown role, as a mistaker of shadow for substance. It is his destiny to be tricked. The mythological hero, reappearing from the darkness that is the source of the shapes of the day, brings a knowledge of the secret of the tyrant's doom. With a gesture as simple as the pressing of a button, he annihilates the impressive configuration. The hero deed is a continuous shattering of the crystallizations of the moment. The cycle rolls. Mythology focuses on the growing point. Transformation, fluidity, not stubborn ponderosity, is the characteristic of the living god. The great figure of the moment exists only to be broken, cut into chunks and scattered abroad. Briefly, the ogre tyrant is the champion of the prodigious fact, the hero, the champion of creative life. The world period of the hero, in human form, begins only when villages and cities have expanded over the land. Many monsters remaining from primeval times still lurk in the outlying regions, and through malice or desperation, these set themselves against the human community. They have to be cleared away. Furthermore, tyrants of human breed, usurping to themselves the goods of their neighbors, arise, and are the cause of widespread misery. These have to be suppressed. The elementary deeds of the hero are those of the clearing of the field. Kutoyis, or blood clot boy, when he had been taken from the pot and had grown to manhood in a day, slew the murderous son-in-law of his foster parents, then proceeded against the ogres of the countryside. He exterminated a tribe of cruel bears, with the exception of one female who was about to become a mother. She pleaded so pitifully for her life that he spared her. If he had not done this, there would have been no bears in the world. Then he slaughtered a tribe of snakes, but again, with the exception of one who was about to become a mother. Next, he deliberately walked along a road which he had been told was dangerous.
As he was going along, a great windstorm struck him and at last carried him into the mouth of a great fish. This was a sucker fish, and the wind was its sucking. When he got into the stomach of the fish, he saw a great many people. Many of them were dead, but some were still alive. He said to the people, "Ah, there must be a heart somewhere here. We will have a dance." So he painted his face white, his eyes and mouth with black circles, and tied a white rock knife on his head, so that the point stuck up. Some rattles made of hoofs were also brought. Then the people started in to dance. For a while, Bloodclot sat making wing motions with his hands, and singing songs. Then he stood up and danced, jumping up and down until the knife on his head struck the heart. Then he cut the heart down. Next he cut through between the ribs of the fish and let all the people out. Again, Bloodclot said he must go on his travels. Before starting, the people warned him, saying that after a while he would see a woman who was always challenging people to wrestle with her, but that he must not speak to her. He gave no heed to what they said, and after he had gone a little way, he saw a woman who called him to come over. "No," said Bloodclot, "I am in a hurry." However, at the fourth time the woman asked him to come over, he said, "Yes, but you must wait a little while, for I am tired. I wish to rest. When I have rested, I will come over and wrestle with you." Now, while he was resting, he saw many large knives sticking up from the ground, almost hidden by straw. Then he knew that the woman killed the people she wrestled with by throwing them down on the knives. When he was rested, he went on. The woman asked him to stand up in the place where he had seen the knives. But he said, "No, I am not quite ready. Let us play a little before we begin." So he began to play with the woman, but quickly caught hold of her, threw her upon the knives, and cut her in two. Bloodclot took up his travels again and after a while came to a camp where there were some old women. The old women told him that a little farther on he would come to a woman with a swing, but on no account must he ride with her. After a time, he came to a place where he saw a swing on the bank of a swift stream. There was a woman swinging on it. He watched her a while, and saw that she killed people by swinging them out and dropping them into the water. When he found this out, he came up to the woman. "You have a swing here. Let me see you swing," he said. "No," said the woman, "I want to see you swing." "Well," said Bloodclot, "but you must swing first." "Well," said the woman, "now I shall swing. Watch me, then I shall see you do it." So the woman swung out over the stream. As she did this, he saw how it worked. Then he said to the woman, "You swing again while I am getting ready." But as the woman swung out this time, he cut the vine and let her drop into the water. This happened on Cut Bank Creek.
We are familiar with such deeds from our Jack the Giant Killer nursery tales and the classical accounts of the labors of such heroes as Heracles and Theseus. They abound also in the legends of the Christian saints, as in the following charming French tale of Saint Martha.
There was at that time on the banks of the Rhone, in a forest situated between Avignon and Arles, a dragon, half animal, half fish, larger than an ox, longer than a horse, with teeth as sharp as horns and great wings at either side of its body. And this monster slew all the travelers and sank all the boats. It had arrived by sea from Galatea. Its parents were the Leviathan, a monster in the form of a serpent that dwelt in the sea, and the Onager, a terrible beast bred in Galatea, which burns with fire everything it touches. Now, Saint Martha, at the earnest request of the people, went against the dragon. Having found it in the forest, in the act of devouring a man, she sprinkled holy water on it and exhibited a crucifix. Immediately, the monster, vanquished, came like a lamb to the side of the saint, who passed her belt around its neck and conducted it to the neighboring village. There the populace slew it with stones and staffs. And since the dragon had been known to the people under the name of Tarasque, the town took the name of Tarascon, in remembrance. Up to then it had been called Nerluc, which is to say Black Lake, on account of the somber forests which there bordered the stream.
The warrior kings of antiquity regarded their work in the spirit of the monster slayer. This formula, indeed, of the shining hero going against the dragon has been the great device of self-justification for all crusades. Numberless memorial tablets have been composed with the grandiose complacency of the following cuneiform of Sargon of Agade, destroyer of the ancient cities of the Sumerians, from whom his own people had derived their civilization.
Sargon, king of Agade, vice-regent of the goddess Ishtar, king of Kish, Pashishu, priest of the god Anu, king of the land, great Ishaku, chief priest of the god Enlil. The city of Uruk he smote, and its wall he destroyed. With the people of Uruk he battled, and he captured him and in fetters led him through the gate of Enlil. Sargon, king of Ugada, battled with the man of Ur, and vanquished him. His city he smote, and its wall he destroyed. Eninmar he smote, and its wall he destroyed, and its entire territory, from Lagash to the sea, he smote. His weapons he washed in the sea.
4. The Hero as Lover. The hegemony wrested from the enemy, the freedom won from the malice of the monster, the life energy released from the toils of the tyrant Holdfast is symbolized as a woman. She is the maiden of the innumerable dragon slayings, the bride abducted from the jealous father, the virgin rescued from the unholy lover. She is the other portion of the hero himself, for each is both. If his stature is that of world monarch, she is the world. And if he is a warrior, she is fame. She is the image of his destiny, which he is to release from the prison of enveloping circumstance. But where he is ignorant of his destiny, or deluded by false considerations, no effort on his part will overcome the obstacles. The magnificent youth Cuchulainn, at the court of his uncle Connachar the king, aroused the anxiety of the barons for the virtue of their wives. They suggested that he should be found a wife of his own. Messengers of the king went out to every province of Ireland, but could find no one he would woo. Then Cuchulainn himself went to a maiden that he knew in Lochlochtha Loga, the gardens of Lough, and he found her on her playing field, with her foster sisters around her, teaching them needlework and fine handiwork. Eimear lifted up her lovely face and recognized Cuchulainn, and she said, "May you be safe from every harm." When the girl's father, Forgall the Wily, was told that the couple had talked together, he contrived to send Cuchulainn off to learn battle skills from Donal the Soldierly in Alba, supposing the youth would never return. And Donal set him a further task, namely to make the impossible journey to a certain warrior woman, Skathach, and then compel her to give him instruction in her arts of supernatural valor. Cuchulainn's hero journey exhibits with extraordinary simplicity and clarity all the essential elements of the classic accomplishment of the impossible task. The way was across a plain of ill luck. On the hither half of it, the feet of men would stick fast. On the farther half, the grass would rise and hold them fast on the points of its blades. But a fair youth appeared who presented to Cuchulainn a wheel and an apple. Across the first part of the plain, the wheel would roll just ahead, and across the second, the apple. Cuchulainn had only to keep to their thin guiding line without a step to either side, and he would come across to the narrow and dangerous glen beyond. The residence of Skathach was on an island, and this island was approached by a difficult bridge only. It had two low ends, and the mid-space high, and whenever anybody leaped on one end of it, the other head would lift itself up and throw him on his back. Cuchulainn was thrown 3 times. Then his distortion came upon him, and gathering himself, he jumped on the head of the bridge and made the hero's salmon leap, so that he landed on the middle of it, and the other head of the bridge had not fully raised itself up when he reached it, and threw himself from it, and was on the ground of the island. The warrior woman Skathach had a daughter, as the monster so often has, and this young maid in her isolation had never beheld anything approaching the beauty of the young man who came down from the mid-air into her mother's fortress. When she had heard from the youth what his project was, she described to him the best manner of approach to persuade her mother to teach him the secrets of supernatural valor. He should go through his hero's salmon leap to the great yew tree, where Skathach was giving instruction to her sons, set his sword between her breasts, and state his demand. Cuchulainn, following instructions, won from the warrior sorceress acquaintance with her feats, marriage to her daughter without payment of a bride price, knowledge of his future, and sexual intercourse with herself. He remained a year, during which he assisted in a great battle against the Amazon Aife, on whom he begot a son. Finally, slaying a hag who disputed with him a narrow path along the edge of a cliff, he started home for Ireland. One further adventure of battle and love, and Cuchulainn returned to find Forgall the Wily still against him. He simply carried the daughter off this time, and they were married at the court of the king. The adventure itself had given him the capacity to annihilate all opposition. The only annoyance was that Uncle Connachar, the king, exercised on the bride his royal prerogative before she passed officially to the groom. The motif of the difficult task as prerequisite to the bridal bed has spun the hero deeds of all time and all the world. In stories of this pattern, the parent is in the role of holdfast. The hero's artful solution of the task amounts to a slaying of the dragon. The tests imposed are difficult beyond measure. They seem to represent an absolute refusal on the part of the parent ogre to permit life to go its way. Nevertheless, when a fit candidate appears, no task in the world is beyond his skill. Unpredicted helpers, miracles of time and space, further his project. Destiny itself, the maiden, lends a hand and betrays a weak spot in the parental system. Barriers, fetters, chasms, fronts of every kind dissolve before the authoritative presence of a hero. The eye of the ordained victor immediately perceives the chink in every fortress of circumstance, and his blow can cleave it wide. The most eloquent and deep driving of the traits in this colorful adventure of Cahulain is that of the unique, invisible path, which was opened to the hero with the rolling of the wheel and the apple. This is to be read as symbolic and instructive of the miracle of destiny. To a man not led astray from himself by sentiments stemming from the surfaces of what he sees, but courageously responding to the dynamics of his own nature. To a man who is, as Nietzsche phrases it, a wheel rolling of itself. Difficulties melt, and the unpredictable highway opens as he goes. 5. The hero as emperor and as tyrant. The hero of action is the agent of the cycle, continuing into the living moment the impulse that first moved the world. Because our eyes are closed to the paradox of the double focus, we regard the deed as accomplished amid danger and great pain by a vigorous arm, whereas from the other perspective it is, like the archetypal dragon slaying of Tiamat by Marduk, only a bringing to pass of the inevitable. The supreme hero, however, is not the one who merely continues the dynamics of the cosmogonic round, but he who reopens the eye, so that through all the comings and goings, delights and agonies of the world panorama, the one presence will be seen again. This requires a deeper wisdom than the other, and results in a pattern not of action, but of significant representation. The symbol of the first is the virtuous sword, of the second, the scepter of dominion, or the book of the law. The characteristic adventure of the first is the winning of the bride is life. The adventure of the second is the going to the father is the invisible unknown. Adventures of the second type fit directly into the patterns of religious iconography. Even in a simple folk tale, a depth is suddenly sounded when the son of the Virgin one day asks of his mother, "Who is my father?" The question touches the problem of man and the invisible. The familiar myth motifs of the atonement inevitably follow. The Pueblo hero, water jar boy, asked the question of his mother.
"Who is my father?" he said. "I don't know," she said. He asked her again, "Who is my father?" But she just kept on crying and did not answer. "Where is my father's home?" he asked. She could not tell him. "Tomorrow I am going to find my father." "You cannot find your father," she said. "I never go with any boy, so there is no place where you can look for your father." But the boy said, "I have a father. I know where he is living. I am going to see him." The mother did not want him to go, but he wanted to go. So early next morning she fixed a lunch for him, and he went off to the southeast, where they call the spring Wayu Pawidi, Horse Mesa Point. He was coming close to that spring. He saw somebody walking a little way from the spring. He went up to him. It was a man. He asked the boy, "Where are you going?" "I am going to see my father," he said. "Who is your father?" said the man. "Well, my father is living in this spring." "You will never find your father." "Well, I want to go into the spring. He is living inside it." "Who is your father?" said the man again. "Well, I think you are my father," said the boy. "How do you know I am your father?" said the man. "Well, I know you are my father." Then the man just looked at him, to scare him. The boy kept saying, "You are my father." Pretty soon the man said, "Yes, I am your father. I came out of that spring to meet you." And he put his arm around the boy's neck. His father was very glad his boy had come, and he took him down inside the spring.
Where the goal of the hero's effort is the discovery of the unknown father, the basic symbolism remains that of the tests and the self-revealing way. In the above example, the test is reduced to the persistent questions and a frightening look. In the earlier tale of the clam wife, the sons were tried with the bamboo knife. We have seen in our review of the adventure of the hero to what degrees the severity of the father can go. For the congregation of Jonathan Edwards, he became a veritable ogre. The hero, blessed by the father, returns to represent the father among men. As teacher, Moses, or as emperor, Huang Ti, his word is law. Since he is now centered in the source, he makes visible the repose and harmony of the central place. He is a reflection of the world axis from which the concentric circles spread. The world mountain. The world tree. He is the perfect microcosmic mirror of the macrocosm. To see him is to perceive the meaning of existence. From his presence, boons go out. His word is the wind of life. But a deterioration may take place in the character of the representative of the father. Such a crisis is described in the Zoroastrian Persian legend of the Emperor of the Golden Age, Jemshid.
All looked upon the throne and heard and saw nothing but Jemshid. He alone was king, absorbing every thought, and in their praise and adoration of that mortal man, forgot the worship of the great creator. Then, proudly he to his nobles spoke, intoxicated with their loud applause, "I am unequaled, for to me the earth owes all its science. Never did exist a sovereignty like mine. Beneficent and glorious, driving from the populous land disease and want. Domestic joy and rest proceed from me. All that is good and great waits my behest. The universal voice declares the splendor of my government, beyond whatever human heart conceived, and me, the only monarch of the world." Soon as these words had parted from his lips, words impious and insulting to high heaven, his earthly grandeur faded. Then all tongues grew clamorous and bold. The day of Jemshid passed into gloom, his brightness all obscured. What said the moralist? "When thou wert a king, thy subjects were obedient. But whoever proudly neglects the worship of his God brings desolation on his house and home." And when he marked the insolence of his people, he knew the wrath of heaven had been provoked, and terror overcame him.
Persian mythology is rooted in the common Indo-European system that was carried out of the Aral-Caspian steppes into India and Iran, as well as into Europe. The principal divinities of the earliest sacred writings, Avesta, of the Persians, correspond very closely to those of the earliest Indian texts, the Vedas. But the two branches came under greatly differing influences in their new homes, the Vedic tradition submitting gradually to Dravidian Indian forces, the Persian to Sumero-Babylonian. Early in the first millennium BC, Persian belief was reorganized by the prophet Zarathustra, Zoroaster, according to a strict dualism of good and evil principles, light and dark, angels and devils. This crisis profoundly affected not only the Persian, but also the subject Hebrew beliefs, and thereby, centuries later, Christianity. It represents a radical departure from the more usual mythological interpretation of good and evil as effects proceeding from a unique source of being that transcends and reconciles all polarity. Persia was overrun by the zealots of Muhammad, AD 642. Those not converted were put to the sword. A poor remnant took refuge in India, where they survive to this day as the Parsis, Persians of Bombay. After a period of some three centuries, however, a Mohammedan-Persian literary restoration took place. The great names are Firdausi, Omar Khayyam, Nizami, Jalal al-Din Rumi, Saadi, Hafiz, and Jami. Firdausi's Shahnameh, Epic of Kings, is a rehearsal in simple and stately narrative verse of the story of ancient Persia down to the Mohammedan conquest.
No longer referring the boons of his reign to their transcendent source, the emperor breaks the stereoptic vision which it is his role to sustain. He is no longer the mediator between the two worlds. Man's perspective flattens to include only the human term of the equation, and the experience of a supernal power immediately fails. The upholding idea of the community is lost. Force is all that binds it. The emperor becomes the tyrant ogre, Herod Nimrod, the usurper from whom the world is now to be saved. 6. The hero as world redeemer. 2 degrees of initiation are to be distinguished in the mansion of the Father. From the first, the Son returns as emissary, but from the second, with the knowledge that I and the Father are one. Heroes of this second, highest illumination are the world redeemers, the so-called incarnations in the highest sense. Their myths open out to cosmic proportions. Their words carry an authority beyond anything pronounced by the heroes of the scepter and the book. The hero of the Jicarilla Apache, killer of enemies, said,
"All of you watch me. Don't look around. Listen to what I say. The world is just as big as my body. The world is as large as my word. And the world is as large as my prayers. The sky is only as large as my words and prayers. The seasons are only as great as my body, my words, and my prayer. It is the same with the waters. My body, my words, my prayer are greater than the waters. Whoever believes me, whoever listens to what I say, will have long life. One who doesn't listen, who thinks in some evil way, will have a short life. Don't think I am in the east, south, west, or north. The earth is my body. I am there. I am all over. Don't think I stay only under the earth or up in the sky, or only in the seasons, or on the other side of the waters. These are all my body. It is the truth that the underworld, the sky, the seasons, the waters are all my body. I am all over. I have already given you that with which you have to make an offering to me. You have 2 kinds of pipe, and you have the mountain tobacco."
The work of the incarnation is to refute by his presence the pretensions of the tyrant ogre. The latter has occluded the source of grace with the shadow of his limited personality. The incarnation, utterly free of such ego consciousness, is a direct manifestation of the law. On a grandiose scale, he enacts the hero life, performs the hero deeds, slays the monster. But it is all with the freedom of a work done only to make evident to the eye what might have been accomplished equally well with a mere thought. Kans, the cruel uncle of Krishna, usurper of his own father's throne in the city of Mathura, heard a voice one day that said to him, "Thy enemy is born, thy death is certain." Krishna and his elder brother Balarama had been spirited to the cowherds from their mother's womb to protect